I'm Samir Patel, editor-in-chief at Quanta Magazine. Our mission at Quanta is to cover what we call basic or fundamental research in science and math. That means the kind of work that's driven by curiosity and discovery and the search for knowledge. We're interested in how and why everything around us works the way that it does. On our brand new show, the Quanta Podcast, you'll meet the writers and editors behind the magazine, and together we'll explore the biggest ideas and the tiniest details. Join me for the Quanta Podcast, your weekly dispatch from the frontiers of science and math.
It started with attacks from the air. Now a maritime phase has begun.
Iran just has to be able to keep the risk up. It doesn't have to hit every ship. It doesn't have to comprehensively mine the straits. It can just keep a little bit of risk. That is sufficient to jam up this vital, vital choke point.
That would be the choke point keeping oil from reaching markets across the globe. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, the complex picture of military strategy in the Iran war. We'll also hear from Southeast Asian residents of Minnesota still reeling from ICE raids in the Twin Cities.
That was terrifying. That shook our community.
Also, a musician weighs in on language in Brazil.
The official language in Brazil is Portuguese from Brazil, but it's not true.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We're going to begin today's program in Iran, where the Strait of Hormuz is now a central battlefield. Three more cargo vessels in the strategic shipping passage have been hit by unknown projectiles. That brings the number of ships struck in the region since the war began to at least 14.
The U.S. military says it destroyed 16 Iranian mine-laying vessels yesterday, as U.S. intelligence sources report that Iran has started planting mines in the critical oil checkpoint. For analysis on where military strategy stands on day 12 of the war, we reached out to Shashank Joshi.
He's defense editor of The Economist, and he started by explaining to me why Iran is shifting its military strategy.
Iran's lost a significant proportion of its missile launches. We see the rate of missile launches against Israel and against the Gulf falling precipitously in recent days. So clearly they're under great pressure, or they're conserving their stocks for a later phase. And they're also suffering from a real problem of political command, with their leadership killed and also unable to communicate freely without risk of being detected by Israel and assassinated. But what they have succeeded in doing is using low-cost drones to conduct fairly precise attacks at short range throughout the Gulf region, including as far afield as Cyprus in the Mediterranean. And they've had some great success with that. In addition to that, we're also seeing Iran try to escalate the level of risk in the Strait of Hormuz, which is, of course, a vital international waterway, a choke point through which more than a quarter of global seaborne exports, oil exports, pass. And they have now begun mining this, in addition to conducting attacks on ships, in ways that effectively make it prohibitively risky for oil-carrying and gas-carrying vessels to pass through. And in fact, we've only seen a very, very tiny handful of ships run the strait every day, and that is partly what is causing oil prices to continue to spike.
So why this shift to the maritime war? Why focus more on the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One of them is the ability to get projectiles and missiles out at Gulf oil facilities is becoming more difficult as the number of launches are hunted by the U.S. and Israel. It may also be that they're afraid of retaliation. We know that Israel struck oil storage tanks in Iran at the beginning of this week, in part as retaliation for what they saw as Iranian attacks on the refinery in Haifa in Israel. So they may be avoiding some of those explicit projectile attacks on Gulf states. But what they do want to make sure is that they keep shipping at risk. And this is a fairly low-cost way of doing it. Their navy has been broadly neutralized and sunk, but they still have small boats that, despite the destruction of some by the United States, are still capable of laying mines. And it really only takes a small number of mines to persuade commercial merchant vessels that it is just not worth going through that strait.
The reporting I've seen on this is a little bit mixed. I'm wondering if you know if those mines have already started to be planted.
I don't know for sure, but the indications we're receiving are that some mines have been planted. These don't necessarily have to be deployed by traditional mine-laying ships, although they're obviously the most efficient way to do it. We know that the U.S. says it's eliminated 16 of those ships.
Right.
You can also lay mines in a variety of other ways, like using fishing vessels, dhows, traditional fishing vessels used in the Persian Gulf region. So there are multiple other low-tech ways to get mines into the water and to keep that risk up for shipping.
Interesting. It sounds kind of like a maritime corollary to the cheap drones that Iran has excelled in military use of.
It is. And this is a strategy that Iran has been thinking about for decades, right? The ability to hold shipping at risk through Hormuz was absolutely vital in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq so-called tanker war that culminated in America and other countries escorting tankers and reflagging them as American through the straits. And that really is what led to this huge American presence in the Middle East we now are familiar with today. This time, you know, Iran is in a slightly different position. It hasn't been able to mine the straits prior to a conflict. It's had to do so whilst there's a huge U.S. and Israeli presence overhead, so it's quite difficult. But I think the key thing is Iran just has to be able to keep the risk up. It doesn't have to hit every ship. It doesn't have to comprehensively mine the straits. It can just keep a little bit of risk. That is sufficient to jam up this vital, vital choke point.
So we've mentioned the U.S. strikes on these mining ships in the Straits of Hormuz. How else are the U.S. and Israel responding to the latest tactics from Iran?
In part, they're continuing to hunt Iranian missiles and drone launches. But in addition to that, they're also trying to think about planning for how you would escort shipping and demine. Right now, escorts do not appear to be a viable solution. We had a brief tweet from the U.S. Energy Secretary suggesting escorts would begin. That was deleted. And I think the U.S. Navy sees this right now as something that is too dangerous until the threat from Iranian projectiles is diminished still, until the threat of mines is diminished as well. What you need is demining vessels. But, you know, what we have seen recently is U.S. Navy mine, what they call mine countermeasure ships, MCMs. These have been decommissioned recently. Right now, I think there are none in the Middle East, if I'm correct, despite the fact that this was a very foreseeable situation. And allied countries like my own country, the UK, have also let their mine capabilities, mine clearing capabilities, atrophy very, very badly in recent years. So right now, we in some ways have a crisis. We do not have an easy, quick, or simple way to get these mines out of the water. And that, I think, suggests a very poor degree of preparation for this conflict.
You've mentioned that Iran's missile launchers have started to be depleted. Where do weapons stockpiles sit on both sides of this conflict?
We don't know for sure. We've got to be humble about this. But we know, as I said, the rate of Iranian launches falling. I think that's probably because they can't get them off rather than because they are losing all their stocks. Many of them are being conserved to eke these out for a long conflict. On the American side and the Israeli side and the Gulf side, the big challenge is how do you intercept these missiles and these drones in a cost-effective way? And particularly, how do you avoid using up your stock of high-end air defense interceptors? These are principally the ones fired by Patriot systems. They're called PAC-3. There's some older ones called PAC-2s as well. THAAD, which is Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System, which are the most capable system for ballistic missiles. We are clearly seeing pressure on those interceptor stockpiles. There's enough for now, but I think there'll be many people in the U.S. military concerned that this conflict will come at the cost of the U.S. having anywhere near a sufficient buffer to deal with a contingency in Taiwan or with China, and it will take years to build these stocks back up to the pre-war levels. Hmm. Now, on the Israeli side, I think you may also see concern that they will have to start allowing some missiles through. They may have to start firing only one interceptor at incoming missiles rather than two or three, and all of that is going to create greater risk of things being blown up on the ground.
I'm speaking with Shashank Joshi, defense editor at The Economist. I want to talk about now the impact on U.S. military bases across the Persian Gulf. There is a large network of them, including in Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. What has been hit so far and what sort of damage has been done on those U.S. military bases?
Well, I think there's two sorts of hits. One of them has been hits to personnel, and we know that obviously multiple troops have died and scores of them have been wounded. And then the second type of hits, I think, have been against U.S. communication and radar facilities. So we've seen some quite precise Iranian strikes against satellite dishes, but particularly against two types of radars. One of them to do with the THAAD system that we discussed earlier. And one of those has been in Jordan, and I think the other one has been in Qatar, with some other potential strikes against early warning radar in the UAE. The U.S. will be concerned about these because these are very, very delicate and scarce systems, and the overall missile battery isn't effective without the radar, without the actual radar to spot the incoming threats. Mm. That may be one reason, although not necessarily the only reason, that the U.S. is now in talks with South Korea over moving a THAAD battery from Asia to the Middle East, which will be a source of considerable concern to the South Koreans, who may already be wondering about the reliability of the U.S. umbrella.
How are those Gulf countries feeling now about hosting the U.S. military?
I think they have very mixed feelings because U.S. air defense systems are taking out missiles coming for those Gulf states and playing their role. So they're being protected by a U.S. shield. And they're feeling very vulnerable being struck by Iran. And they didn't expect the ferocity of the Iranian response. They feel betrayed and angry. But at the same time, I think they're concerned about the capricious approach taken by the United States, the sense that Donald Trump has been opaque on his objectives, the sense that they don't know whether he will end the war tomorrow. And so if you're a state like the UAE or Qatar or Saudi Arabia, and you're thinking, do I join this war to try to punish Iran for these strikes? You are less likely to do so if you think that the US could call time on this tomorrow, and then you would be left holding the can. I think they're also very angry at this war being forced upon them when they didn't ask for it. They tried to stave it off, and now they're facing, in some ways, not just physical destruction, but an assault on their very political model of being havens for business, for tourism in a tumultuous region. That no longer looks so much like a haven.
I want to broaden out now and talk about the global impact. The war has the price of oil skyrocketing by design. That benefits Russia since it is a major oil producer. What does the war mean for Russia's military?
Well, I think I'd say two things. One of them, it means that the source of interceptor missiles globally is coming under great pressure. And Ukraine may be worried that it has already had to conserve its stockpiles hugely. It may be struggling to get these. You know, we know some European countries like Germany have tried to buy the PAC-3 interceptors that go into these missiles, these missile defense systems. And they've been told by America, you can't buy them. We don't have enough. So this will, you know, for months, maybe years to come, further limit that global supply of interceptors Ukraine needs. And what's the result of that? It means that more Russian missiles will get through.
Hmm.
The second big concern is Russia's economy was in real trouble. But what we're seeing with the oil price spike, as you pointed out, is that they can now take a little, that pressure is easing. They can breathe, they can build up their buffers. They have staved off a crisis that would have come had there been any kind of economic shock to the system. You know, this war has been good for Russia. And the final instance, we're also seeing countries like India granted waivers by the United States to continue purchasing Russian oil. So even the sanctions regime is showing some signs of not buckling, but perhaps a few more holes in it. And I think the Kremlin will be very pleased with that.
Mm. What about China? What might its military leadership be taking from this conflict so far? We've kind of glossed over Taiwan. Let's dig in there.
They'll see the devastating effect of this decapitation of the Iranian regime on day one, and that will make them more paranoid about the protection of Xi Jinping and their leadership. It will also make them think that this is an effective and justifiable way to open a conflict by killing the Taiwanese president, if that's what it comes to. That's not new. They knew that before, and I think that would have been in their planning. We know they've had, for example, a mock-up of the Taiwanese presidential palace in China for many years, but I think that this really puts that to the forefront. I think in addition to that, these wars are big learning opportunities. We know China has learned from the Russia-Ukraine war in terms of the kind of military systems that are effective on the battlefield, the role of the growing role of low-cost missiles.
Given the tactics that the U.S., Israel, and Iran are employing that we have been talking about, do they suggest to you that this is shaping up to be a short and punishing war or more of a long and drawn-out conflict?
Well, it's always a very difficult thing to peer into the mind of President Donald Trump, who one often feels doesn't entirely know what he may do next, let alone convey that to others. But I think in this case, the impact on energy markets is going to put huge pressure on Mr. Trump, especially in a midterm year in the United States, to try and curtail this sooner rather than later. I think Israel wants to go for a while. They think they can still do much more damage to the Iranian state. I think they want to degrade the regime to the point where it could viably collapse after the war is over. I think the United States is open to that outcome, but that's not their priority. I think their priority is much more limited, and I think Trump will be keeping a very, very close eye on the oil price and its effect on the stock market in the United States and how business confidence is moving in response. And therefore, I think it is unlikely that this war is going to go on for another 3-4 weeks. I would think it will find its way to a close sooner than that, not least because there will be a degree of exhaustion on all sides.
Shashank Joshi is the defense editor at The Economist. Thank you, as always, for your insights.
Thank you very much for having me.
A Ahead on the show, anxiety and solidarity for one immigrant community in Minnesota, and much more global news, including a math revolution that's got some in the field excited and others concerned. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Immigrant communities in Minnesota have been targeted by federal law enforcement. In January, ICE agents who flooded the state arrested and deported residents and killed two American citizens. The Trump administration has since switched course, and last month the number of arrests dropped. ICE still has a presence there, and people in targeted groups remain on high alert. The World's Sarah Hassan was recently in the Twin Cities to find out how the Hmong community, largely in the U.S. by way of Vietnam and Laos, has been affected.
Do not talk to them!
This video, taken by a bystander, shows the moment that ICE agents forcefully arrested Minnesota resident Chung Lee Scott Tao from his St. Paul home. Tao, who is in his mid-50s, is wearing only shorts and Crocs, a child's blanket draped around him, as he is taken away in sub-freezing temperatures by agents wearing tactical gear. Onlookers blow warning whistles and car horns as they shout at the agents. The raid was part of a federal immigration crackdown on Minnesota's Twin Cities called Operation Metro Surge. It reached its peak earlier this year after the Trump administration deployed 4,000 agents to the state in December. It mainly targeted people from the Somali, Latino, and Hmong communities. After breaking down his door without a search warrant, Chung Lee Tao, who goes by Scott and who is Hmong American, turned out to not even be the person the agents were looking for. But the video made its rounds online and sparked horror through the Hmong community.
That was terrifying. That shook our community.
Cam Yang is a second-generation Hmong American, a child of refugees, and was raised on the east side of St. Paul. As a community organizer, she's glad to see people come together at this difficult time.
It has been so heartwarming. It has been so wholesome to see everyone so united.
Especially because she says this hasn't always been the case. During the police brutality that led to the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in 2020, there was a split within the Hmong community.
It was mainly because, you know, a lot of Hmong men, and even women become like police officers or enlist within the army. It's something that is kind of ingrained into our community, especially because, you know, of our immigration history and our refugee stories of fighting alongside the U.S.
During the Vietnam War in the 1960s, the U.S. secretly recruited and trained Hmong men in neighboring Laos to help fight the communists in North Vietnam. After the war, they became targets by the Vietnamese for their collaboration with the United States. Thousands of them fled to refugee camps until they could be resettled in other countries, including the U.S. With this history of serving alongside U.S. forces, the ICE crackdowns have left many in the Hmong community feeling confused and betrayed.
We still fearful that who and where we're going to be stopped and questioning or take away from their families.
Chung Pao Lee is the executive director of the Hmong Cultural Center in St. Paul. He said that children have been afraid to go to school, especially because ICE agents sometimes use them as bait to arrest their parents.
My kid, they are afraid of it, and he expressed that if not drop off and pick up, he will not go to school.
The Hmong Cultural Center has been around for more than 3 decades. In addition to offering classes and other services, it's also provided a safe place for kids to come together. Although ICE operations have wound down, people are still on edge.
But we know that they are still here and they are still executing on their operations, and their targeting is still very similar.
That's St. Paul Mayor Kalee Herr. She took office in January at the height of the tensions in the Twin Cities. The city has traditionally been welcoming to asylum seekers from all over the world, she says, and many of the people who were detained had their papers in order.
and those individuals because ICE was not familiar with their paperwork. We had a number of them actually get sent to facilities in Texas. We've had people who were detained because they were trying to be observers. We've had people who were just randomly getting targeted because of the way that they looked or the way that they sound and would be detained for hours.
She said that many people also ended up being deported to Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America. At Hmong Village, a shopping center for traditional clothing and ingredients you'd need for traditional recipes, community organizers Bobby and Hui browsed the stalls. Neither of them wanted to share their full names. Hui says there wasn't a lot of support on the ground at first because not too many people of Asian descent were initially being stopped.
Once that's kind of started ramping up, you know, our group really started to grow and we started to organize to see how best we can communicate and educate our community about what's happening.
Bobby says the Hmong community in the Twin Cities is unique because of its density and people's proximity to each other.
And so we have the privilege of building a lot of political infrastructure for ourselves, and we build a lot of power in that way.
A power base that includes Mayor Kali Her, who is the first Hmong American to hold that position. The mayor is collaborating with other local and state officials to offset the upheaval her city has been through.
I joined a lawsuit with Minneapolis Mayor Fry and Attorney General Keith Ellison. We have joined lawsuits across the country around just trying to hold ICE accountable.
She says that she's been thankful that all the communities have come together to help each other out.
When it's one community, it's very easy to let that go under the radar. But when it was multiple communities and we were all standing up together, it made our voices much stronger and we could fight against this federal government.
For The World, I'm Sarah Hassan.
And now for some headlines from the world of science that might have flown under your radar.
We begin with hedgehogs. Hedgehogs in Europe are being killed by cars, which is sad no matter what, but the hedgehog population is also in decline. They've been newly classified as near threatened. Hopes are high for a solution. New research out of the University of Oxford today found that hedgehogs can hear high frequencies in the ultrasound range, which suggests that ultrasound technology could be used to keep hedgehogs off the street.
Another discovery, this one with implications for humans. Japan has approved stem cell treatments for Parkinson's. The therapy plants stem cells in a patient's brain. That is actually one of two new stem cell therapies Japan has just approved. The other, called ReHeart, treats severe heart failure by helping to form new blood vessels. Both could potentially be available to patients in Japan by the summer.
And this last item has to do with a NASA mission from 2022. The DART mission was intended to test NASA's ability to keep an asteroid from hitting the Earth. It was already known to have successfully smashed into a small asteroid. New research published Friday now shows that the collision also changed the orbit of that small asteroid and a much larger one it was linked to by gravity. The experiment marks what one member of the research team has called a notable step forward in our ability to protect Earth from space rocks.
And those are a few science headlines that caught our attention. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The 2001 Australian thriller The Bank introduces us to a boy in elementary school who is precociously gifted in mathematics. As an adult, he takes his deep knowledge and uses complex computational models to manipulate the world of finance.
What would the benefit to society be if we could predict the next market crash? This mathematics allows us to predict almost anything.
Well, we're in the midst of another mathematics revolution right now, and it's not on the movie screen. It's happening because of artificial intelligence. What it may be capable of mathematically is what we're going to find out. And if, like me, you were good at basic arithmetic but struggled with more advanced ideas around math, we'll take things slowly with our guest, Daniel Litt. He's an assistant professor of mathematics at the University of Toronto. So, Daniel, you predicted last year that there was only a 25% chance AI could best a human mathematician like yourself in writing a mathematical paper by 2030. And you already had to revise that forecast. Is that right?
So what I would say is that I was pretty skeptical just a year or two ago that AI tools would be able to autonomously do research at the level of the top mathematicians today within the next 5 or 6 years. What I think is likely true is based on the rate of capabilities improvement right now, that it's quite possible they'll be able to do high quality research autonomously. That said, I would expect, if that's happening, humans working with AI tools to do even better research.
Right. And that seems to be a key point. But a big leap in a year. How exactly is AI changing the field of mathematics?
Yeah. So right now, I would say a good rule of thumb is that AI tools are able to do mathematical tasks that someone, maybe a world expert in a given area, would find easy. So that's really useful. Like, individual mathematicians are not experts in everything. So being able to do something that someone else finds easy is very powerful.
Right. So that's one level of how AI is changing the field of mathematics. Take us to other changes.
Well, maybe let me just step back a little bit. So 2 years ago, the models could do very little. They would struggle with basic arithmetic. One thing that's changed a lot in the last couple of years is they've gotten very good at coding, and they've gotten more reliable with proof, so rigorously checking that a mathematical statement is true. So in my view, the two ways the models have become useful for mathematical research is, first of all, they can prove statements that would maybe be previously required an expert to prove, and they can do very involved coding tasks that let you kind of explore a mathematical phenomenon in some detail, which would have been challenging, would have been much more time-consuming previously.
Right. So we know that AI has its blind spots. I remember recently seeing that some AI chatbots struggle with answering just how many R's are in a word like strawberry. ChatGPT apparently did learn that, though. How do we know then that AI has solved a previously unsolved proof when that time comes?
One challenge with using these models is that they're not truth-seeking. So they'll often produce something that they claim to be a proof, and then it may or may not be correct. And it's very difficult to check. So in fact, a lot of using the models to do mathematics is they generate some claim and then one has to check it. And that's challenging.
So humans still have to check the AI. When do you think that's going to change? Or will it ever change?
I think it's quite likely that it will not change for some time. You know, autoformalization work has the promise of making some AI mathematics more reliable. But yeah, we'll see how long that takes. Certainly, I don't expect that to be practical in all areas of mathematics within the next couple of years.
So, Daniel, how would you kind of describe what's at the heart of the debate about AI's role in the future of mathematics?
So right now, what I would say is the capabilities of these tools are to do tasks that would have previously required an expert, but were more or less routine for experts. And then the question is when and if the tools will be able to do non-routine tasks. Based on the trajectory of capabilities, my expectation is that that will happen soon in the next couple of years, maybe.
So no real timeline. I mean, is it just going to depend on technology and getting it right?
My personal expectation would be that we should expect to see AI tools doing high quality autonomous research in the next 5 years. But definitely, that's not a unanimous view in the mathematics community.
Daniel, in the past, I imagine computers were used to help confirm mathematical equations. Are we seeing a role reversal?
So historically, the way computers have been used in research are, well, you generate a huge number of examples and analyze them. And then there's a few cases of proofs, which break up into hundreds or thousands of cases, and many of those cases can be resolved by a computer. So maybe famously, the proof of the four color theorem, which is that you can color a map with four colors so that any two adjacent countries have different colors, required some computer aid. You should think of current use of AI tools as being a natural continuation of that.
I mean, I remember when calculators, I was in junior high school, and they became affordable enough that kids in classrooms could take them to school. And then there was a debate about whether that inhibited our development of problem-solving skills. Is AI the next stage in that debate, or is this fundamentally a different conversation?
I think personally that it's a natural continuation of that question. You know, anytime you develop a new tool, it both enhances our capabilities, you know, by using the tool, and it also means that certain old capabilities and old techniques that one pursues are less useful and less relevant. So I think that's just the natural progression of technology, is that you gain capabilities and then the tool itself substitutes for some of those capabilities you needed previously. I think that's okay.
I want to return to the clip we heard from that movie, The Bank. I mean, how could all of these changes impact things in the world of finance, for example, where math is really important, or policymaking, where decision outcomes are often assigned to probability?
That's a great question. I mean, I think one exciting thing about the tools is that they'll broaden the availability of mathematical techniques. So I think people who previously would not have tried to make a mathematical model for something might now have the capability to do that. You don't need as much expertise to use the tools to do mathematics as you needed to do it without AI tools previously. There's some danger in that. I think one can misuse a tool, of course. But yeah, my hope is that they'll lead to a democratization of mathematics and more people thinking mathematically and asking interesting mathematical questions.
Daniel Litt is an assistant professor of mathematics at the University of Toronto.
NATO has now shot down two Iranian missiles headed toward Turkey. Iran has denied firing the missiles. The incidents have rattled Turkish authorities, who've said repeatedly that they want nothing to do with this war. That stance seems to be resonating with many Turks that reporter Ayda Uzunlar spoke to in Istanbul.
Spring crept into Istanbul this weekend. The sun was out, and it brought people with it. Just a few days before, every news channel covered the first missile NATO shot down after it came into Turkey's airspace. It was all over social media and on the radio. But on Saturday morning, there was steady foot traffic from tourists and locals in the popular Jahangir neighborhood. A 26-year-old Iranian woman sat at a cafe on one of the busier streets. She didn't want to share her name because she says she's scared of retaliation from any government. She's been scared of her government since protests first broke out in her country 2 months ago. They killed thousands of people, she says. They shut off the internet. I couldn't talk to my family. I couldn't get any news. I cried every day. She moved to Turkey 2 years ago. She knows family and friends back home could be in danger. Still, she says she's relieved that something is happening to change the status quo. I'm happy that this war is happening, because without external intervention, we can never be free from the hands of the regime, she says. I just want them gone, and I want our country to be free. She says she knows other Iranians have different perspectives, but she doesn't even know where to get news that she can trust. So she waits for the short phone calls she gets from her family to hear what's happening directly from them. The Bosphorus is a straight shot down the street. There, a middle-aged Turkish man sat by the water for a lunch break. He didn't want to give his name for the same reasons as the young woman at the cafe. But his thoughts on the war are vastly different from hers. The fact that a senator in the American Congress determines the welfare of a child in Tehran or Gaza shows that the world is not fair, he says. The man in charge of America should be in prison, not in the White House. He says that the U.S. has no business in the Middle East, and he voices a theory that the missile NATO shot down in Turkish airspace was actually sent by Israel as a way to get the U.S. further entrenched in the region. Most of the folks I talked to in Istanbul said the same. The man says he's not afraid of Turkey getting involved as a mediator. We're very suited to this role because we're both Western and Eastern and neither at the same time, he says. We're Muslim, but Western values are very high. Turkey doesn't make big enemies, and it won't push its people into a war. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan gave an address Monday after he spoke to the Iranian president. He said Turkey does not want to get involved in the war, and he still strongly opposes airstrikes on Iran. But he also stressed opposition to Iran's actions.
İran'ın başta Can Azerbaycan ve Körfez ülkeleri olmak üzere.
We openly stated that we never approve of Iran's attacks targeting sister countries, he said. This will serve no purpose other than exacerbating common pain and sowing the seeds of hostility between brothers. Lunchtime was up, and my bench partner excused himself. I met Sylvia Tafikova and her family at a restaurant along the same stretch of water. They were on vacation from Slovakia and arrived the day the first missile dropped. I caught her while they soaked up the sun at an outdoor table.
It's amazing. I came here for this exact thing. I love it. From the Turkish soap operas and the series.
Tafikova's news source to understand travel safety was a well-known Slovakian influencer living in Istanbul. She sent a message over Instagram and...
She assured me that life in Istanbul was going on like every other day and you couldn't tell any danger or any tension or anything. It feels safe to visit Istanbul for now because we don't know what appears on the news tomorrow or any other day.
I went to pay for my cup of tea. An elderly man at the register had the radio on. He said he didn't know what station it was, but it didn't matter because all the news is bad. I asked if he wanted to share his thoughts. He patted his right hand on his heart, a polite Turkish thanks, but no thanks. The news on the radio was serious, but he still smiled. For The World, I'm Ada Uzunlar.
Staying with news on Iran, we have an update to a story we brought you yesterday about five members of Iran's national women's soccer team being granted asylum in Australia. Last week, the team did not sing the Iranian national anthem before a match in the Women's Asian Cup, drawing intense scrutiny from the government in Tehran. Yesterday, two more members of the squad accepted Australia's offer to stay in the country. But this morning, Australian Immigration Minister Tony Burke told Parliament that one of the women changed her plans and will, in fact, return to Iran.
In Australia, people are able to change their mind. People are able to travel.
Burke said the Australian government had done its due diligence to be sure the team members returned to Iran had not been forced.
My officials made sure that this was her decision, and every question you would want asked was asked.
The team member in question had contacted the Iranian embassy and requested to be picked up. However, her call revealed the location of the other asylum seekers, who then had to be moved by police to another secret location to ensure their safety.
Any linguist will tell you that if you're trying to pin down the roots of a language, you'll often find rich and diverse influences from many sources and places. Take, for example, the language known as Brasiliano. It's spoken in Brazil and mixes Portuguese, languages from the country's indigenous communities, along with languages that came to Brazil from enslaved Africans. Many advocates of Brasiliano say it's a truer reflection of the complex history and people of Brazil. Musician Lucas Santana counts himself among those advocates. He even calls his new album Brasiliano. Here's Lucas Santana with Brazilian legend Gilberto Gil, a song titled A História da Nossa Língua, or translated, The History of Our Language.
Mulher na flor do lácio, latina e rueira é vulgar. Cruzou o Mediterrâneo, sarau occitano.
Lucas Santana spoke with me recently about Brasiliano, both his album and the language.
So Brazilian is, it's a possible name for a Brazilian language because in the constitution in Brazil, the official language in Brazil, it's Portuguese from Brazil. But when you study the formation of a Brazilian language, it's not true. It's impossible to say that we speak Portuguese. So Brasiliano, it's the possibility of a name for a Brazilian language, you know?
You feature eight different languages on your new album, and one of the tracks features indigenous singer Tainara Takua singing in the language of Tupu-Guarani. This is a language that was replaced centuries ago by Brazilian Portuguese. How important is Tupi-Guarani in Brazil's history?
The first 2.5 centuries, the most popular language on the street in Brazil, it was língua gerais, general language. That was a mix between Portuguese and indigenous language. So each region speak a general language, different general language, you know? So the Guarani, for example, in the part of the state of São Paulo, it was predominant, you know? So each region of Brazil, there was an indigenous language predominant that made the mix with Portuguese.
And the language of Tupi-Guarani is the basis of what you were just talking about, linguas gerais, the main language spoken in Brazil. during its first 2.5 centuries. So let's hear a bit of Tainara Takwa singing in her Tupi Guarani. And then, as we'll hear, you'll come in singing. So that's Lucas Santana performing there with Tainara Takua. Lucas, it sounds like you did a lot of research around language for this collection of songs. Have you always been fascinated by linguistics?
No. It was a great surprise for me. And now I'm completely fall in love for linguistics. How the words travel and after centuries change just a letter or mixed with indigenous language and transforming another word, you know, it's fascinating.
So Brasiliano is a mix of languages, Brazilian, African, Latin, and that is reflected in your music. So here you're performing with the Brazilian band Os Paralamas de Sucesso.
Que seja um reggae, que seja leve. O sol como penhor pra que a luz não se apague. Seja reggae.
So here we've got a reggae rhythm, Lucas. Do you feel that the language of music can break down barriers that the use of words cannot?
Music is a universal language. Rhythms travel along the time, the space, you know. So it's similar with the linguistic stuff and music stuff, there's a lot of things that are similar to things, I believe.
Escuta tua língua, reconhece teu povo.
Brazilian musician Lucas Santana, his new album is Brasiliano.
Nossa história.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Jalisco New Generation Cartel is one of the most powerful criminal organizations in the world. 2 weeks ago, Mexican authorities captured and killed its leader, known as El Mencho. But the cartel itself is still intact, and its reach goes well beyond drug trafficking. It has consequences for local businesses, transportation, even food supply chains. As we hear from The World's Tibis Isaiah in Mexico's capital, what happens to the Jalisco cartel now could have an enormous impact on daily life across the country.
With 22 million residents, Mexico City is home to one of the largest food markets in the world. It's called the Central de Abastos. Every morning before sunrise, trucks arrive carrying thousands of tons of fruit, vegetables, flowers, meat, and fish from across the country. Vendors stack boxes of avocados and limes, and buyers move through the aisles looking for the best price. But many people here say those prices are not set by supply and demand. A fruit vendor tells me limes and avocados have stayed expensive for years because of the fees narcos charge. He says criminal groups demand payments from farmers and distributors, and those costs eventually show up here at the market in what customers pay. Mexicans call this narco-inflation. One of the groups most deeply involved in extortion of entire industries in Mexico is the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, also known as CJNG. Security consultant Eduardo Guerrero says The cartel grew to a scale Mexico had never seen before.
Cartel Jalisco es un tipo de cartel que nunca habíamos tenido en México por las dimensiones que tiene.
Guerrero says the organization is made up of more than 100 criminal groups operating across Mexico, and it's involved in every kind of organized crime business, he says.
Cartel Jalisco está metido en todos los rubros de negocio del crimen organizado mexicano. Es uno de los grandes exportadores de metanfetaminas.
Apart from being one of the biggest exporters of fentanyl and meth, this cartel is involved in fuel theft, agricultural extortion, illegal fishing and mining, human trafficking, money laundering, online scams, and more. It has a presence in every Mexican state and has been spreading its influence to other countries. David Mora from the International Crisis Group says the cartel also developed unusual military capacity.
We're talking about almost a paramilitary organization with a lot of discipline among its forces. And they've also gained access to rocket launchers, grenades. They were the pioneers in fitting drones with explosives.
With the cartel's leader gone, analysts say the big question now is whether the organization holds together. Some say it could fragment with rival factions turning on each other. Chris Dalby, head of the security think tank World of Crime, says powerful commanders inside the cartel control their own territories, weapons, and revenue streams.
If even one of them fractures, even if one of the commanders fragments, the CGNG will likely go to war, and that could be a very protracted civil war because these commanders have a lot of their own guns and men and finances.
But others say the cartel has strong reasons to stay together. Security consultant Eduardo Guerrero says the group rewards loyalty and punishes desertion.
Entonces, los costos a los que están sometidos quienes deciden separarse son muy altos.
He says, for members, the risk of leaving is high. They can be killed or disappeared by members of the cartel or from rival groups. But even if tensions exist inside the organization, analysts say violence may not happen, at least right away, especially with the Men's Soccer World Cup coming to Mexico in June. David Mora from the International Crisis Group says the tournament itself is unlikely to be affected by cartel violence because for criminal groups, a global event like this can actually mean more business.
I mean, the influx of millions of tourists, they demand, they consume drugs. They demand sex, which is also, you know, another racket that the criminal groups operate.
He says cartels are not motivated to scare tourists away because they generate profits. Chris Dalby says criminal groups often make money from the entire tourism industry.
A staple of theirs is also money laundering through tourism infrastructure. So that is extorting hotels, restaurants, bars, all of the businesses that make money from tourism.
But once the World Cup is over, tensions inside the Jalisco cartel could still surface. Eduardo Guerrero says weakening a cartel this large takes far more than capturing one leader.
Yo creo que tienes que irlo desgastando, erosionando sus capacidades financieras, sus capacidades de soborno.
He says it's a monumental task that requires a slow, targeted strategy, going after its money, corruption networks, and the officials who protect it in every municipality. U.S. cooperation is essential, he says, because the vast majority of guns used by Mexican cartels come from the U.S. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Some final notes from Iran. Residents of Tehran reported loud airstrikes, explosions, and heavy fire today. Many reportedly took cover in shelters. We'll be following up on those reports.
Earlier this hour, we had a military analyst on the show discussing the strategic importance of the Strait of Hormuz, which has effectively been cut off as Iran begins putting mines in the waterway.
Meanwhile, member countries of the International Energy Agency today agreed to release 400 million barrels of oil from their strategic reserves to offset what's been lost in the global market. That is the largest emergency oil release in history. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear about the impact that shortage is already having on daily life in India.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Please join us again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.